Before we get started with today's show, I want to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, First Draft. ESPN experts Mel Kiper Jr., Todd McShay, and Field Yates keep tabs on the NFL draft throughout the year, but they're in the home stretch now and really finding their rhythm. This week, they discuss last week's trade frenzy and how it impacts the 49ers. Plus, what does it mean for the rest of the first round? Follow First Draft as well as The Right Time wherever you get your podcast. Also, baseball is back and so are your favorite teams and players. Catch the best of the bigs all season on ESPN Plus with over 170 live MLB games featuring every star and every team in the league. Sign up now at ESPNplus.com/baseball. The Right Time is brought to you by Goodyear, helping you discover the road ahead. Goodyear, more driven. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You'll only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. It's that time of week where we have a guest join us, and joining us now live from beautiful Connecticut, Mike Golic Jr. What's going on, man?
Not too much. That actually doesn't feel like a lie today. We're in that little sweet spot where Connecticut starts to put on for a while before you go instantly from the dead of winter to August-style humidity. So you're not technically lying to people right now.
Yes, yes. Now check Golic out, Chanae and Golic, 4 to 7 Eastern on ESPN Radio. They have a podcast that you can subscribe to. Go ahead and check that out. And I'm curious, what's Connecticut like now that your dad's gone?
It's weird, man. Like, so we got out here in 1998 when Dad started working at ESPN Radio at first. And so we've been in Connecticut as a family for the better part of 23 years then. And my folks just sold the place that we grew up in. Like, they're full on getting the hell out of here. So for me not to have them like 15, 20 minutes away is going to be a weird adjustment a little bit. Like, that's going to get some taking used to. But I guess an almost 32-year-old man, like, you probably can't gripe about your parents leaving too much at this point, especially when they're going out and living in a warm place that I can go visit now anytime. So it's kind of a nice excuse to get out of here every once in a while.
Yeah, no, he's doing retirement for real. Scottsdale, Arizona, baby. Like, we are out of here and we are going to not do a lot of work.
So we lived out there when my dad first got done playing. One of his first jobs, he was doing, you know, some TV stuff, but, you know, it was like that pay-as-you-go contract type stuff. But he was working at a ESPN Radio affiliate out in Scottsdale. So we lived there for like 3.5 years as a kid. And my God, when we got the news, because at that point, Dad was flying to Bristol like 4 nights a week to do what was NFL Tonight at that point.
Right.
And so he was gone more than half the week. It became one of those things that was unsustainable. And so finally, my parents were like, hey, we're moving to Connecticut. And all I knew as a third grader at that time was it was cold up there and none of my friends were there. And man, I was crying up a storm. I couldn't believe that they were going to do us like that. And it delivered on the cold and my friends not being here. It worked out all right. And it was nice to have Dad around more. But that news didn't go well with anyone, especially not Mom.
Well, one thing I've always been kind of curious about with you and your dad, and this is a broad thing that I'm curious about, is what happens when you're named after your father and people know who your father is. You know, so like for you, playing football as Mike Golic Jr., was it harder as Mike Golic Jr. or was it easier in some ways?
Well, I always said it was easier because we always talk about having role models and stuff. Like, everything I wanted to do, because I wanted to be my dad when I was a kid. Like, I had my heroes in my home. And so I had a guy who had done everything I wanted to do and knew how to get to those places. So, like, playing football as Mike Golic Jr., I had someone I was watching tape with in high school with way more knowledge than any of my coaches or any of my peers at that point. And so having that set of eyes on the things that I was doing and the feedback that I could get off that was super valuable. Like, I got the nepotism thing then too, when it was like, all right, well, you want to go play at Notre Dame, you're going to be some sort of legacy case there and stuff like that. So I got hit with a lot of that early, which it was what it was. Like, if you stayed off the message boards, then it was a little bit easier to kind of avoid any of those criticisms. But I'd say around here, it was never really a bad thing. It always, to me, was like, I had a resource that everybody else didn't have in my area. And to try and act like that was ever a bad thing was just not going to be real for me.
Also, I think the legacy part is kind of interesting because, with all due respect, they were sorry when he was there.
Oh, I was going to say, the Jerry Faust years is like the dark ages. You go, and that's the thing, is like, Jerry's a nice guy. He'll show up at the bookstore and like, he would come and sign his book and all that stuff. And everyone loved him now that he wasn't coaching the team anymore. But like, yeah, They don't talk about those years at all. They're like, dad was a captain, but you got to search to find all that stuff because they've tried to scrub it from the records.
You know, like I think about, you know, you joke a lot about playing that national championship game against Alabama, which I'll tell you my story on that. I think I was flying back from Bristol. I was flying back from Bristol to North Carolina the day of that game. And I was like, cool, I'm going to be on the plane for the first half of it, but I'll get home in time to watch the rest. And I landed at halftime. I checked the phone and I was like, nope, I don't think I'll be checking. The score is 28-0.
I felt bad for my parents that they had to stay. Because like most other fans, they could leave. Like I had friends that came down there and you know, won the tailgate and all that stuff they fall back on to try and make it seem less brutal. But I just remember there was one point in that game, all the stuff at the beginning, like kickoff, running out there. Like it's awesome. You're playing in a national championship finally. And then it was like somewhere in the first quarter. And I'm just sitting on the sideline. And we were a defensive-led team that year. Like, we had, you know, I think four or five future pros in our front seven. Like, that was the strength of our team. They were, like, the number one defense in most categories that year. And I just remember watching them from the sideline. I had, like, the perfect downline angle just get rolled off the ball by Chance Warmack and Barrett Jones. And I just looked over at one of my buddies. Like, my buddy Braxton was our center. He's my roommate all through college. And I just looked over at him, and I go, what the hell is going on? Like, that didn't happen to them. So once I saw that, I was like, all right, I know the way our offense is built. I don't know if we got enough bullets in the chamber to go out here and come back if they're not going to get a few of these stops we're accustomed to.
Yeah, it's like if Foster talks about he played that Orange Bowl his freshman year in Maryland. They won the ACC, and they got the pleasure of going down there and playing a Florida team that was national championship good, but then lost, I think, the last game of the year. It's like one of those hurricane rescheduled games, and it's just that moment where you realize, oh, wait a minute. Not only are we not going to win, we are not going to keep this close.
So there are two ways this is funny, because one is I remember the week leading up to it. This is how confident apparently Alabama was. So we were ranked number one at that point. So we were technically the home team. So our team got to choose which hotel we stayed at. And our coaches were like, we're going to stay up in Hollywood. We're going to be away from all the stuff going downtown in Miami. So Alabama was staying at La Fontainebleau. Like they were in there with Liv and all that stuff. And about Wednesday of that week, there were articles written. Like this was known that Alabama had to have a players only team meeting because too many dudes were going out and getting after it during that national championship week, getting ready for this game. And so we're like, all right, bet they're losing focus. They've been here before. Didn't help them none in all of that stuff. But yeah, that was a nice reminder that not only did they win, but they got to stay at the fun hotel too.
I mentioned that one because I feel like as bad as that game may have felt, your father played in a game in Miami that probably felt worse. That 51-7 game, I think it was in 80. Jerry Faust's last game where Jimmy Johnson just decided, okay, I mean, like, yeah, we got the backups in, but the backups like to throw bombs too.
Oh, yeah. Brutal. But that was the norm for him by them at that point, because when he got there, this was the real pain is I want to say when he got there, they were still riding off the high because he was like 82-85 or something. That was his years there.
Right.
And when he got there, his freshman year, they went out. I forget who they beat week one, but they were ranked like number one in the country. And then they went on the road and got punked. And then after that, it was all downhill. So he came in and that was the best it ever was in his career. And the rest of the time looked a lot more like what you just described.
Yeah, no, but like that one, you know, for like, especially black people, Miami was us, man. We ain't never had nothing like this before, right? Like in the way they were doing it at Notre Dame had just always been like this fixture. It changed a bit when Holtz came in because Holtz was like, look, you got to try to win or what? We'll get some students too, don't get me wrong. But like, y'all try to win? Okay, cool. That's what we're going to do. And then that game, I wasn't old enough to remember it, but I hear my dad and my brother talk about it. And for them, that was just like, oh yeah, we here now. Like, it ain't us, it ain't ours, but they're like, oh, we here.
You know what? That's interesting to me because I was talking to someone the other day about what Notre Dame and Miami is now because we've had some of the recent games between the two. Like, so the first time we played Miami since like 92 was when I was in school. We played them in a bowl game first, and then we played them in the regular season my last year. And someone asked me about like the feeling around that rivalry a while back. And I was like, for me, who like was born in 89, so I kind of missed the back end of that stuff. It didn't really mean much. I remember being at that bowl game. We were playing them in the Sun Bowl in El Paso, Texas. So we were both bad football teams. And we showed up to one of those luncheons where they put both teams together. That always seems like a really bad idea. And I remember Marcus Forston, who was a D tackle for them at the time, comes walking by the table and everyone's talking shit in there. And he looks up and goes, man, y'all dreamed of being Canes growing up. But we looked, I was like, you're 7-5 here too, man. Like, we didn't dream of being you. And then, God, before the start of that game, it was 32 and snowing in El Paso for game time. And I just remember looking over in the tunnel and seeing all those dudes, every bit of cold gear they packed on the trip. That's like Tuesday in South Bend, so we weren't really like messed up with it at all. But we looked over and saw them huddled together with every bit of cold gear, and we said, oh, yeah, this is over. We're good here.
Oh, yeah, and it had to be rough for them, too, because, like, the Sun Bowl is one of those bowl games where it means something in El Paso. Like, it's a big deal in El Paso when the Sun Bowl comes to town. But imagine you Miami, right? You've been kicking it in Miami, and now you're out here, and it's cold, and somebody's trying to explain to you why it's such a big deal to be out here in El Paso. They're so happy to see you, and you ain't happy at all to see them.
They speak South Bend's love language down there, which is effort. We are not a destination in any of the normal ways, which means as a city, you got to put on some effort to make people feel like they really want to be here. You talk to anyone who played in that game on our end, had a great time. Everyone went to the Three-Legged Monkey or whatever the name of that bar is around there. We got all the speeches about not going over into El Paso, but you're right. I bet those Miami guys, for a lot of reasons, had a way worse time.
Yeah, so you got the speech about not going to Tijuana, but did you? Oh, is it Tijuana or Juarez? It's Juarez. Juarez. No, do not go to Juarez, but did you do it?
No, didn't make it over to Juarez. We had a cab driver, so the first night we went out, because you know, like those first few days of bowl, like there's no curfew or anything, like it's kind of understood those first two or three days of the free-for-all days. And I remember being in a cab with one of my buddies, one of our other O-linemen, and the cab driver's like, yeah, I know a couple of places right across the border. He's like, I can pop you right over there. And we're like, nope. All good. Don't need any of that. Just get me to the normal stuff.
Yeah, let me tell you, if them boys over there watch any ESPN, you would be the prime target for abduction.
Man, so you talked about before the name and what it means in certain spots. Like, that would be one thing. But, like, my freshman year, I brought this up on HQ the other day when we were on, but I got arrested for, like, minor intoxication with, like, 40 people. And the only two names on the bottom line were mine and the other football player. And as a redshirt freshman, mine wasn't because of my athletic accomplishments on the field up until that point. Like, that was Dad who got the joy of having to address that on Mike and Mike later that morning.
Well, that's the trick bag on that one, right? Is that ESPN, on one hand, they'd probably like to look out for you, but they know they can't. And so now you have to be sacrificed in the name of fairness. Not even sacrificed, but you know what I mean. Like, okay, no, we got to run this one out here.
Yeah, knew that was going to be the one. So Dad had fun with that. That was the nice 3 a.m. call that him and Mom got before that one was going down. Like, hey, they're about to put my cell phone in this bag, but just to let you guys know what's happening.
Now, I always think about your dad, because fun fact with him, we moved to Houston the same year. Like, I want to say he played in Houston in 87 before he went to the Eagles. And I would love to talk to your dad about the Jerry Glanville Houston Oilers. Like, I can only imagine going from Jerry Faust Notre Dame to you and Alonzo Highsmith, by the way, showing up the same year to play for the craziest team that football has, the least disciplined operation I've ever seen. Just knock the hell out of people. That's just all we're here to do. Echo of the Whistle should have been the nickname of that whole team.
And that was just like what followed Dad his entire time, because you go from that to Buddy Ryan's Eagles, and it's like the stories from that team are unbelievable. Like, just the thing, because like Jerome, Clyde, Reggie, all those dudes, like Buddy wasn't happy unless people were throwing hands in practice, but like you had dudes that were ready to go and pop the trunk after certain things on there. And like Buddy was always involved in it. Like Buddy was a character in these fights in a way that you would never think of a head coach now going at. But that's a wild team to hear about. But you're right. I'm sure the Houston days were great too, because his rookie year, he broke his ankle. So he was on IR that year. So he was just chilling, observing at that point.
And your dad on that Philly defense was the one not like the other. And I'm not talking about it in terms of talent. It was him and then those 10 dudes.
Oh, there's a picture hanging in our office right now at home in my parents' office, and it's my dad and the entire D-line, and the one of these things is not like the other, and I forget who signed it, if it was like Jerome or Reggie, but it says, to the honorary black guy, Mike Golick, hanging in the office there. Like, he was always the odd man out. It was unbelievable, but it somehow worked.
That's one of my favorite things about football, though, especially with defense. That winds up being what it is, because the offensive lineman, there's always some white dudes on the offensive line. You can form like a little bit of a clique on that one. Now, if you defense or somehow in the defensive back room, oh no, you're going to learn all the jams.
You're going to come out of there. That was like, honestly, one of my favorite things about a college football locker room is I came out with a whole bunch of music that I did not hear in Avon, Connecticut growing up. Like, I got out of college and I was like, oh man, this is amazing. Like, we got a whole bunch of things I could tap into in this spot that I have stolen and heard every drop from in the locker room from all this pirated music we got to listen to.
Oh, that's right. Big in school in the era of music piracy. Like, because it started right when I was getting out that all that got going. By the time you were there, it was full up and running.
The Empire.
See, when it first got started, when I was in school, is when Napster first got going, and nothing was better than Napster, because the way that Napster worked was just basically everybody who was logged on at the time, you had access to their files, and it was the only game in town. So that meant that you had access to literally everything, because nobody was going anywhere else. So you could find the most obscure things at that point, because everybody was coming to the same place. When it started getting segmented out, and then like LimeWire comes around and everything else, it got to be harder. But there were some things that I could find on Napster, or could find and then mess around and didn't get for whatever reason, that you couldn't get anywhere else, right? Old stuff, like you don't even know it existed, like unreleased Marvin Gaye type stuff. I mean, granted, we were theoretically stealing, you know, but I wasn't gonna buy that shit, no way. Like, it wasn't like he was gonna get this money from me.
I feel like that's kind of what we've lost now in a number of senses, like whether it was that or like what's gone on, like obviously like everything surrounding buying sneakers, primary or secondary market, has kind of gotten messed up. But with that and music, we've kind of lost that hunt in all of it now. Like, it's way easier to find most things, but you don't have that sort of access to the things that no one else can find there. Like, there's no digging really to do anymore, unless you're really trying to get into, like, unless you can like hack or code or anything like that, that I certainly can. I'm sure there's some ways around a lot of this stuff, but even as music's expanded and become more digital like that, we've lost all the goods.
Now I'm gonna switch gears a little bit to like the sports stuff that we typically do here on this. Are you a draft guy? Like, does the draft light you up?
I like the draft because it feels like the one time NFL Twitter has to acknowledge the college football side of things. Like, I appreciate the draft process. I do like a couple of like digital draft shows for us, but it's more fun for me to watch all these people that only live on the NFL side coming over and finally having to put eyes on these college players we've been watching for a while.
Yeah, like, I think everybody wants to be a GM now, right? Like, that's like the weirdest thing about this current time. I think there's a whole lot of people who just gave up on the idea that they'd ever be like players or whatever it is. And so they're like, yo, I would be a great general manager. Fantasy football has fooled them into believing this. And so everybody, like, I always tell people, and they're like, yo, I want to look up all the prospects so that I can be ready for who my team decides to take. And I'm like, whoever your team takes, you're going to lie to yourself and tell yourself that they're good. Like, the guy that you slammed all the way through this process, no, you're going to come around, because what's the fun in not coming around? Like, you might as well just wait.
Oh, it's so true. The fantasy football aspect, and it's also like analytics. Like, that's opened the game up to a whole bunch of people that were never going to play a down of all of this. And so it is interesting. And I think, like, selfishly coming at it from like the analyst side, because I cover college football, I do games and stuff for us. So there's part of me that likes being the guy that can go out and say, oh yeah, like, I watched your dude, let me give you this little bit of draft currency before you go into this. I know your guy. So there's like the little high that comes with that from our side here. But in general, it's just kind of overblowing a bunch of stuff that doesn't matter and a bunch of mock drafts that are just here to make my job on radio easier.
Yeah, and how frustrated do you get hearing people not know nothing about offensive line play try to talk about offensive line play?
You know what? I've said I appreciate the fact that people care enough to try, but there gets to be certain points where we got to clear out and just, you know, let the reformed fat people kind of handle this one. The worst part is, too, is between draft Twitter and then O-line camps Twitter, where you get like all these people celebrating things that are not celebratory. Like, the other day, some clip was going viral again of some big kid tossing some kid into the quarterback at one of those camps where people are doing pass rush run-on-ones with no pads, and all the O-linemen like collectively come out and we're like, we got to do this public service announcement that this is not the way you play this position, and then make sure that the general public understands this is bad, because we appreciate that people want to come and learn, but we know it's kind of a weird place to wade into if you didn't at one point do it. Like, why else would anyone want to look there too often?
Man, I get so tired. I be having these regular people on Twitter. I'm not mad at them. In my own way, I'm a regular person, but you get where I'm coming from here. They hit me with the, well, if you watch film, you are not watching no damn film. You are reading other people talk about watching film. And that's cool, because that's largely what I do, right? Well, if you watch film, you would know. So tell me when you have time to watch film and you got a real job. And I'm not talking about people who like blog on football and they've taken this as like something that they do. I'm just talking about people like, well, you know, not everybody watches film. You are not watching. It's like with people with this damn bill in Georgia. You ain't read that damn bill. You ain't watching no damn film.
I was just going to say, it is the handshake meme of people who said, read the bill. Like, oh yeah, in the 4 hours since this headline came up, you read all 100 pages of that bill and are coming here and lecture me on it. Yes, I believe that's exactly what happened in this spot. Jesus.
The draft is like, especially as I work here, and I talk about this, and I don't mean to imply anything sinister when I say this, but it's just kind of the nature of what sports coverage is that we have to find things compelling to keep you going. The NFL and our network have figured out how to keep people on the hook about this draft for months. Because for right now, for the month of April, this is what it is. Like, we're going to get past the Masters. And since the NBA season isn't even home stretch, really, like in the way that we would typically be off of this, the draft is like way up there the whole other way. And so we wind up in this Justin Fields thing where Justin Fields is falling up and down a draft that hasn't happened, right? Like, that's the thing. Always remember, the draft has not happened. Draft stock does not really exist. And now we see that guy since the end of the season hasn't played a game. People like him a lot less than they had before, like him more in some cases. And then I look at Trey Lance and I'm like, literally, I haven't heard anyone say a solitary word about you. Not a one.
It's been amazing. And it feels even weirder to see all this because we didn't have the combine as kind of that point to ricochet off of, because usually we come out of that and you have the teams that have time to meet with them. You have all of those quotes that end up getting leaked from those interviews with players that generally tend to be like a ricochet point for us in the middle of this process that kind of starts to, you know, let people latch onto something enough to alter these. But we've been having to like cut in midair on our own in a lot of this stuff. The Trey Lance thing, I was thinking about this the other day, especially relative to what's going on with Justin Fields, is I think with Trey Lance especially not playing this year, us kind of having that one Central Arkansas data point that most people are excusing because of the circumstances, and just saying, we know you're talented enough, but not enough for us to really have to worry about you in the top end of all this stuff, because that's where Justin Fields should be. And so most people, when you start to try and drop him down, realize, like, anyone who's seen Justin Fields for any amount of time gets really uncomfortable with that for all the obvious reasons. But with Trey Lance, I feel like that's a big instance where so many people are just taking someone's word that he's good enough to be drafted in the first round. But outside of that, no one's explored it enough to care any more than that.
My theory, they don't know he's black.
Ah.
North Dakota State, yeah. Right? And you only see him in a helmet and everything else. Could kind of go either way. Like, let's be honest, he is light enough that maybe you might not know, but too dark to not be black in North Dakota because they don't get no sun. Like, as Justin Fields is going through all the black quarterback stuff, Trey Lance seems like he'd be the easiest one to throw stones at for the reason you just pointed out. He only played one game last year, and it wasn't very good. He played against 1AA competition before that, and he's just over there like, nah, I ain't taking no pictures. I ain't doing no interviews. I ain't seen nothing at all from him whatsoever, and he'll probably go somewhere between like 5 and 8.
It's amazing because, like, you even go back to the year prior, like, one of the biggest tapes I see going around is the game they played against James Madison in the FCS championship. And his calling card in that game was he rushed the ball like 16 times there. Like, I was talking to Mina about this. It was like he was pinballing off these little guys. Like, he goes out there and he runs the exact same stuff that Carson Wentz was running. Like, it was the same issue trying to figure out Carson coming out of North Dakota State, because you had a dude with a strong arm the way Trey does. But most of that offense is running inverted V and mixing a lot of quarterback counters and quarterback power runs in there, and then giving you some shots down the field out of all these like traditional day one install power eye sets. And so it's a difficult thing to translate. You see all the ability, and by all accounts, Trey's one of those guys that gets all of the positive connotations to the things around his game. I don't know him from Adams. You know, I don't really wade into that stuff, but you see the talent there, but it's just a difficult offense to look and then translate to today's NFL, because it is so much of early 90s NFL pro football.
Yeah, now in this draft, in sum total, like, I don't really know what to do with Zach Wilson, because Zach Wilson spent all season playing against bums. And honestly, I have seen the same four highlights for him over. And like, once it was decided or concluded that the Jets were going to take him, we stopped like paying any attention to what it is. Like, that's part of the coverage, is that once we decide that somebody's going somewhere, we're not going to do it anymore. Trevor Lawrence, if you wanted to go in there and nitpick Trevor Lawrence, you can. Like, I've read some stuff from some other, you can do it if you want to, but he's going number one, so we're just not going to do that, right? Fields is the most compelling of all the players, right? And even Mac Jones, now that we seem to know that Mac Jones is going number three, we're just like, okay, he's going number three, and we're just not going to talk about any stuff involving him other than he doesn't seem to be very fast, right? But past that, there's nothing compelling there. Apparently, Fields is the only one that it seems like the machine has found, like, yo, there might be some up and down variance in the ways that it goes. And I just have a hard time believing that there are that many GMs that are going to let him fall. But so far, it's a struggle for me to see that happen.
It is amazing because with all of these guys, especially like the Mac Jones and the mystery around Zach Wilson, that we've become so enamored with all this. And I wonder if part of it is the lack of information, because you think of what these teams are accustomed to being able to go out and get, that COVID in the last couple of years has really changed. Because like the draft process for all of these teams has put a lot more of a premium on, all right, what have your numbers people and what have your people, like smart people in the building, been able to build to try and make up some of this information gap? Because we've seen the 40s at all these pro days. We know not all of that's legit. Like the 40 at the pro day is going to be different because you're hand timing all that stuff. But how are these teams now going and making that transition to going out and measuring game speed, doing all these things? And the bad teams that tend to pick at the top of drafts seem to me to be the ones that it would make most sense get left behind in this information age. And so they default to, well, we're here and we need to pick a quarterback, because this quarterback class is really good, but we've seen some other great ones. And we're talking about 5 in the top 9. Like, this seems kind of insane the way we're bottlenecking this all at the top.
Yo, and here's my thing about like pro days. I ain't never seen a quarterback have a bad one. Like, I'm sure somebody has a bad pro day, but we do this every time. We get all so hyped up about the pro day. And I was thinking about this because I was thinking about like basketball players. Like, do you see that clip the other day of some high school kid trying to take Brian Scalabrine at the gym, and Scalabrine just destroyed him? And it's your reminder, these guys are so much better than you have any clue about. And that probably applies to a lot of these college football quarterbacks. Like, I feel like I could put any college football quarterback out there in a pro day, and if I told you going in, this guy is going to be a first round pick, whether he should or should not be, they can make some of them trick throws. They can do some of that stuff because these guys are really, really good at what they do. I feel like nobody's ever messed up at that pro day. And I was wondering about, like, for offensive linemen, what do you do at the pro day other than throw up weight?
Pro day O-line wise is basically a lot of the same drills that you see at the combine there. Like, they're trying to figure out, are you strong enough and athletic enough for us to ask you to do the things that we need you to do? Like, you want to talk about a two different worlds pro day experiences. Like, for me coming out, when I was coming out, when I left after my fifth year, it was me and one of my buddies who were both ended up being undrafted guys. There was not one offensive line coach that worked us out. We got worked out because Tyler Eifert was going to go get drafted in the first round at tight end by the Bengals tight end coach who ended up drafting them. And so we went through some blocking stuff. I came back the next year to do the pro day again after I got cut. Zach Martin's year coming out. Got worked out for an hour and a half by 4 different offensive line coaches wanting to see you pull, wanting to see you fire out from the ground, wanting to see you fire out of a stance in different directions. A lot of the same stuff you would do in practice as an offensive lineman, but they just want to see you move, because if they put you through enough of it and in those positions, they're just trying to figure out, like, do you have the strength necessary in a bunch of these different spots and the flexibility we need to slide you out to tackle, to move you inside if we need to, and to ultimately, like, handle the baseline. Like, you're right, the pro day is just checking a box for the baseline. Do you meet enough of the physical standards for us to then go and look at the rest of this stuff if you're someone we're considering?
And that looks useful for, like, offensive linemen in particular. And just hearing you talk about that gets to something I try to explain to people all the time that they do not get. If me and you were to go run a race, you will smoke me. People have a drastic misunderstanding of what the athletic ability is that is required to play offensive line in college, or especially in the NFL. Like, imagine being 300 pounds in a 3-point stance, and then at the drop of a dime, you got to not just get up and go out to the side and go find some little guy to put your body on.
It's a weird thing to think about, like, the amount of power that you've got to generate going into these spots. And that combination, because I've always said, like, that's the biggest difference for me between college football and pro football is what you see along the lines of scrimmage. Like, if you stare at one line in the pros and one line in college long enough, you see just dominant high-level athletes across the board in the NFL. Whereas in college, you're going to see some stiffs. You're right, better athletes than most of the population, but that level of athleticism at the pro level where you're going to be, especially now the way pro defenses have evolved and got so much faster, you've gotten more sub packages built in. It's like, you're going to get challenged. And if you've got one really weak link, they're going to exploit the ever loving hell out of it. Like, there's only so much sliding you can do against these kind of exotic defenses and live to see another day.
Yeah, no, like, I just think Quentin Nelson, when he was at Notre Dame, I just can't imagine being that big, that strong, and that quick.
Dude, I walked into the gym. I went back to Notre Dame one time after I graduated, and it was when Quentin Nelson and Mike McGlinchey were the left side of that offensive line. McGlinchey ended up being a first rounder, like 3 picks after Quentin to the Niners. And I walked in mid-workout, and I'm just staring at these two kids. And I looked up, and I had one of those moments, like, thank God I am not here anymore. These guys would stuff me in a locker. Like, we played the same position, and we might not even be the same species. Like, if you look at Zach Martin, Zach is pretty impressive physically, but for the most part, he's a dude that had to put it on gradually. Quentin walked into this with a different level. Like, that dude's yoke up top, it's just something different. He has physical tools the rest of these guys don't. And I was happier than hell that I didn't have to try and compete and take the job of, or try and keep a job from a thing that looked like him.
Yeah, like, guys in this draft, Sewell is the only one where I think of where, like, you know, if you are not somebody who understands this offensive line thing, watching the offensive line draft cutups, it's only but so entertaining, right? Like, you could have a guy like Becton, right, the dude that plays for the Jets, who's just so damn giant. And you're like, oh, my God, look at that giant man go. Quentin Nelson was like my buddy Spencer said about Cloudy when Cloudy was coming out of high school. You don't need the arrow. Because when it's a lineman in a clip, they have to give you the arrow so that you know who you're looking for. No, it will make itself abundantly clear very quickly with Quentin Nelson who the person is. And Sewell is the same way, where it's like, you'll see very quickly who this is about.
Well, especially with Sewell, because, like, as far as, like, the linemen that, like, I look at, because, like, I try and take a look at most of them throughout the year that are coming out, he might be one of the best, like, screen offensive linemen. Like, his natural understanding of all these things. And so you're right, all the highlights you get of him are out in the perimeter. Like, he's away. Like, when you're in the scrum in there, I don't expect most people to be able to follow all the stuff, all the pull arounds and everything like that. But he's always out on these screens just laying out little dudes. And that is easy for us to all ooh and ah at here. So he is doing a lot for the O-line community by getting out there in space and getting the love he deserves.
Screens had to be fun, right? Like, I feel like if I was an offensive lineman, I would look forward to every time you said we were running a screen.
Oh, it's great until you get that first time where the DB decides to go low on you and you're not ready for it. Because, like, throwing on them is fun in space and trying to run them over. But that first time, because you're not nearly as athletic as he is. Like, if I'm running at Dominique Foxworth in space, we know the far lesser athlete in that spot. And if he decides, no, I'm going to make the pile here, it's a lot tougher for me to hit that sprawl and try and keep my knees out of it. So that first time will humble you quickly on one of those. But for the most part, you just get to try and blindside these little guys.
Do you remember this dude that played for LSU? He's from Houston. Craig Lawson, defensive back.
Name sounds familiar.
Lawson was like a five-star recruit, and it didn't really go for him at LSU. Like, he didn't turn into an NFL player. But I just remember watching his high school tape because, you know, he thought he might go to Texas. And everything was him submarining people, right? Because it's a different era of football. You're not going to have jacked up shots. But everything of him was him putting his shoulder in somebody's thighs. And I just imagined him when you were saying that, a dude like that, like, oh, screen, I guess I'm going to have to take your legs out. You're the one that called screen.
So there's guys like that that are dangerous. But then I remember talking. So when I was with the Saints, you and I have talked about Teron Armstead before. Yeah. Arkansas Pine Bluff, ran that blazing 40 time and been with the Saints. I remember talking to him about Cam Chancellor one time. He's like, I'll never forget. I don't even think it was a screen, but he went on one of these like tackle pulls and pulled up there. And he goes, I went up to hit Cam. And the next thing I knew, I was readjusting my chin strap and just rubbing my jaw. He's like, I'd never seen anything like that space alien on the second level. Kyle McCarthy, a guy who played like 4 or 5 years in the NFL, was a safety for us at Notre Dame, was next to him in the combine. Kyle was a white safety. Kyle was, you know, shorter, going to be a special teams guy, great captain and all that stuff. And he stood next to Cam right in line. They were one number after the other at the combine. And I remember him coming back like, maybe I'm not cut out for this. Maybe I'm just not supposed to do this.
By the way, speaking of white safeties, you went to school with Harrison Smith, right?
Oh, yeah.
He is white, right?
Yes, Harrison is white, confirmed.
Yo, I could never really tell and get a definitive answer on that, but he was the Dave Aranda of defensive backs, where I was just like, does anybody know for sure like which direction this is going in? I can't get anybody to, like, he's actually pretty fast. This kind of throws it off. I don't really know which direction we're going in here. I needed somebody to definitively let me know this, because I really didn't know. Like, once the white DB turns out to be really good, now all bets are off.
Yeah, I am happy if nothing else comes out of my time on this podcast, I can definitively confirm Harrison Smith is white. And Harrison Smith is a white safety in name only, because he has like none of the other tropes there. Like, that dude's just a freak. So when we were early on, Harrison was a year older than me at Notre Dame. And he came in, and in John Tenuta's defense, he was our DC like my first or second year at Notre Dame. And in that defense, he was playing like now what we see all the time, that like nickel star position in college football, right? That's sort of the hybrid dude. Harrison was playing out of position there. Like, we were playing it as like a Sam linebacker, like a straight up box outside linebacker. And then once the staffs changed over and we got to Brian Kelly and all them, all of a sudden they moved Harrison back to safety. And we all just kind of looked around one day and we're like, holy shit. he's really good. Like, I remember the DBs, they used to call him the eraser in the DB room, because you would literally cut tape on of Harrison. Like, I sat with one of our DBs one time and they showed me, and it would be this wide open hole on like an outside zone or something, like 8 yards in between, running back looks like he's going to go for days. They would stop it right there, and then they would hit it a second later, and Harrison would just come. You'd see 22 fly from the other side of the screen and just take dude out. And like, once he tested all that stuff at the combine, all of us were like, yeah, that's him. But the rest of the people were like, how is this white safety doing all of these not white safety things?
I also forgot that in Tenuta Does America, the grand tour of John Tenuta's attempt to work at every university in America, I forgot that he had gone to Notre Dame. But it's always good for like a year, maybe two, right? And oh, it's always heat. Tenuta is here to bring heat.
His voice is the one, like, it was him and, yeah, Rob Ryan was the DC in New Orleans when I got down there. And those are the two voices you could hear from down the hall, like in their meeting room as it's going on. John Tenuta and Rob Ryan, you could hear from anyone on there. But I just remember, you're right, I remember watching John Tenuta and Georgia Tech give Brady Quinn hell on the road when I was not at Notre Dame yet. And then all of a sudden getting there and he shows up. And once I saw our defensive practice, I was like, yep, that makes sense. This is like a hornet's nest.
Yo, Georgia Tech is the weirdest school in football for me for this reason. It's really hard to do what you have to do to go to Georgia Tech and play football at Georgia Tech. Like, Notre Dame and Georgia Tech are in the same category, except the difference is where Notre Dame has the thing where everybody has to take calculus freshman year, and that's the weed out. Georgia Tech has that and then everything else for the rest of the time. Like, I got a buddy that got a full ride for a PhD in economics at the University of Michigan after getting a 2.5 at Georgia Tech, because Georgia Tech is that hard of an institution. And I'm supposed to go down here and play football, but they would always have like pros on defense. The theory always is at schools like that, you can scheme an offense, but you got to have players on defense. And Georgia Tech would be messed up not being good on offense and just having monsters on defense.
It was wild to try and make sense of all that, because you're right. Roddy Jones, who works for us now at the ACC Network, was there as like a slot back, you know, when they were still running the triple option. That's what's most interesting to me about Georgia Tech now, is trying to make that transition back out. Like, Jeff Collins does all the right stuff in modern college football to try and get the buzz around things. But man, like you said, you just know they're fighting an uphill battle when you're trying to go out here and now play straight up with people as opposed to what they were doing before.
Yeah. Georgia Tech did like the equivalent of, well, I guess we're going to shoot underhand free throws, right? Like, going to Paul Johnson is like, you know, you may not like the way it looks, but who knows the next time they'll win the ACC, which I think he pulled off like twice, which is pretty amazing when you stop and think about it. But don't nobody want to do that, man.
There's no greater hell than option week. Usually there were years where we play all three service academies, but we have the, you know, longstanding tradition with Navy. And it's just like this collective groan walking into triple option week when, you know, if you're on the scout team, it's opposite hand stances and trying to fire out and cut people. And when you get to the game, it's all right, well, which of our defensive starters is going to be out for the rest of the season? Because you know it's coming.
You remember that year? I think it was the year that Alabama played you guys in that bowl game where they had that incredible defense, but they would have to like segment out the stats. It'd be like Georgia Tech versus FBS competition because they played South Alabama and Alabama was out there running the ball. And it threw all their numbers off. Like, they had to take the 1AA game out in order to account and make the defense look as good as it was.
That's always the weird thing that happens too, because like, haven't we see that before with like the Citadel? Doesn't the Citadel run the triple? And like, they did that to Florida one year when I think it was Will Grier, when he was still at Florida.
Yeah.
The Citadel gave them that weirdly tough game before he got knocked for the performance enhancing drugs or whatever, and their season fell apart. But I just remember watching that one weirdly. Like, every once in a while, you got that one weird 1AA team that gives the SEC hell.
With this draft coming up, one thing I have noticed in it, it's we're talking so much about quarterbacks. Everybody seems to think, though, that the best player in this draft, quite possibly Trevor Lawrence included, is your man Kyle Pitts. Tell me what you think about this. As you know far more about football than I do. I feel like that variety of tight end is like the most underrated weapon on offense. If you got a guy that you can send into the huddle who is a wide receiver, but you could also set him up in a line, what do you call against that? Every time I see a guy like that come out, like, look at what a Gronk does. Look at what a Travis Kelce type player does. That ain't no tight end. We looking at this the wrong way. You got to think about it like fantasy football. That's a W/R/T.
Yep. I can say it is all the above in that spot. And I think the one thing we underrate in football, because so many people talk about, you know, this being a spread league now or the move away from all that stuff. Like, it's always going to be a league where options win. And I think you've seen, like, if you trace back the really good teams, I always say you've got good big skill players on most of the teams that we've seen be successful. Going back to probably like the 2015 Falcons, that version of Kyle Shanahan's team was made by the fact that they had fullbacks and tight ends they could use and exploit in the middle of the field in that spot. Even going back to like Bill Belichick's Patriots, that's always the easiest spot to try and cause chaos if you're an option, because especially with the way that we've seen, certainly in college, the paces move faster, but even in the NFL, you've started to get some more of it. Defenses can only account for so much, and now that you've got all this pre-snap motion in there that's messing up what they want to call and how quickly they can adjust in this spot, now all of a sudden, if you've got to pay attention to that and figure out what the space alien that's either attached to the line or split out is going to be used for on that particular play, like, it's the ultimate chess piece. It really is nothing more valuable. And like we see it with Kittle and all these guys, I think we understand it to an extent, but this draft's going to push the limit because what Pitts has been able to do to people routinely in the best conference in college football was terrifying.
I bet he was an intramural basketball monster.
I haven't stopped thinking about it this entire time, Bo. Like, we would sit at Notre Dame and we would sit around in our locker room. And a lot of this had to do with the makeup of our basketball team, but we would have dudes all the time in our locker room. Like, man, if we got a starting five together, because we had D1 offers for basketball in there, we could give them a game. Kyle Pitts could give anybody a game, I'd imagine, because tight end is always the position I think is most inclined to hoop. Like, I think that it's the best combination of the things that you need. I would pay money to see Kyle on a basketball court while he's getting ready for the NFL right now. I bet he can do some famous things.
I don't know if I ever told you this, but many, many years ago, I started writing. I never got anywhere close to finishing, but I was trying to write a book about Randy Moss, and I had done a sample chapter, and the sample chapter basically ran from high school to the draft with him. And, you know, there's a lot of talking about, you know, him playing basketball because he's a great basketball player and going to Nike camp and everything else. And between him and Antonio Gates, I was like, if I'm ever out here looking for a receiver or drafting a receiver, my first question is, did you play power forward in high school? Because if you did, I have a place for you. Because when you think about Randy Moss in that context, going up to get a rebound, he's better at that, you know, than anybody. Just he's like a 6'4 power forward. That does not work in real life unless you are Charles Barkley, right? Antonio Gates, that was the same thing because he was out there muscling cats when he was at Kent. I remember that year that they ran through the tournament. He was just out here muscling dudes. And, you know, they're like, hey, how'd you like to come try to play some football? I think this thing might work. That's what I think about with Kyle Pitts. And he runs routes. Like, he's out here doing that one where you go in and then you turn your whole body back around and then come back. I'm like, oh, that looks very difficult to do.
Everything he does, and again, like, high degree of difficulty playing against great teams a lot of them. Like, it's not like he wasn't covered in a lot of those instances, but when it gets to that point, like, I always want the guy who's better is better. And like every spot like that, those jump ball spots, which is really, that's the biggest basketball touch point. I remember Notre Dame, Tyler Eifert was a pretty darn good basketball player. His dad played at Purdue back in the day. And of every guy I played with, between him, Michael Floyd, Golden Tate, Kyle Rudolph, all those dudes, Tyler Eifert was the best jump ball player I've ever seen in my life. And it was all those basketball reasons. But with Pitts, I just don't know what you do against him. Like, in line, he's not the greatest blocker. But again, that only matters so much because you can put these guys off ball. Like, you're going to always give him help in these spots. You're never going to ask him to be like another tackle in those instances. But he can do enough. I only need you as a running back and a tight end to be willing to block. I don't need you to always be like great at it. Like, you don't got to be George Kittle, who's elite at it. Like, the Iowa tight ends come with something different. But if you're just willing, that's better than 75% of the people at those positions. And you're already going to be good enough.
All right. We got one last question I'm going to ask you before we wrap this up. We do a thing on this show I think you're familiar with where you very often ask people, like, when was the moment that you realized that you didn't want to play football no more? Did you have a moment as this guy that you were achieving, you know, going to achieve your pro dreams, where something happened and you looked at a dude or something was across from you and you were just like, nah, don't think this is going to end the way that I want it to?
I'll take you to the exact moment I knew it was over. This is the one. I forgot about this. Davidson, he was a D tackle for the Saints. He was like a fourth or fifth round pick out of Fresno State for them. Tyler Davidson. And we were in camp running a 2-minute drill in 2015. And I remember we were going down and it was pretty like in the middle of the 2-minute drill. So we're all out there on the field and our coaches are all right behind us. And I distinctly remember in the middle of that 2-minute drill being gassed. And I overset Tyler. I was playing guard. He put his hand in my chest, launched me back. I landed on my ass, looked up. My offensive line coach was right there and he just shook his head. I got back up, ran to the huddle, and I go, there ain't no way in hell I'm making this team. Like, This is a wrap. That is the exact moment I can go back to mentally every time when I know my football career was done. I played in a few preseason games and did all that. We finished out training camp. But I knew in that moment, there is no way in God's green earth he has let me play on this football team after seeing that.
I had never thought about it in that idea that, like, I could never live this down with that man.
Oh, yeah. Like, the guy that was in the head of the room at that point just looked right down at me, and I'll never forget, like, the disappointed parent look on his face. And I got back. I was just like, yep, this we can go ahead and wrap this one up.
All right. That is Mike Golic Jr. Check him out. Chiney and Golic, 4 to 7 Eastern on ESPN Radio, produced by our guy Shannon Penn. Hey, man, I really appreciate you coming on with us and joining us. We're going to have to do this thing here again. It's been fun doing television with you. So thank you, man.
It's been nice. Appreciate you having me, man. Thank you.
All right, no problem. And ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing three times a week. Gabe Bassan and Tony Collette, you handle everything behind the scenes. Thank you, fellas. Remember, subscribe to The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. And we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.